I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. During and since last year's presidential election, reporters and pundits have searched for the beating heart of American populism. That search often brings them right here to Appalachia. From the stream of stories that followed and continues today, the region has largely been distilled into one basic vision: disaffected male white coal miners, skeptical of globalism and of outsiders who look to Donald Trump for salvation. Our guest today on Dialogue says that portrayal isn't even close to accurate. Historian and writer Elizabeth Katz says most of what you've read and heard about Appalachia and her people is way off the mark. She's here for a substantive discussion about the nuanced reality of Appalachia. Join us for Dialogue after this news. Thanks for joining us for Dialogue on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth at 91.9 FM WUOT, your NPR news station. Appalachia's the place to be, at least for reporters and columnists searching for, well, exactly what are they searching for? An explanation for Donald Trump's appeal, the plight of former coal towns, explanations for the rise of the alt-right. Yeah, all of the above, and more, too. Our guest today says Appalachia is often used as a canvas, allowing commentators and pundits to paint whatever picture they like. And she says it's usually way off the mark. Dr. Elizabeth Katz is a consultant, historian, and writer. She studied at UT and earned her PhD at MTSU. She's the author of the forthcoming book, What You Are Getting Wrong About Appalachia, which is slated to come out early next year. And she's with us for this hour on Dialogue. Dr. Katz, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for joining us today. And I want to let everybody know we want to hear from you, too. We have a box set up on our Facebook page where you can submit a question about the myths of modern Appalachia. You can tweet us at WUOTFM. Some folks have already done that. Or you can join us the old-fashioned way. We're going to open up the phone lines here. In about 15 minutes, we'll give you the number here shortly. Elizabeth, I want to start first with your own background. You're not the Yale academic who's coming in from outside to tell us old Appalachians what's going on. You're one of us. What is your own background?
So great question. My background is I was born and raised in East Tennessee. My grandparents are from East Tennessee and also Southwest Virginia. So on one side of my family, I have coal miners, and on the other side of my family, I have people who were sort of forced into migration by the TVA. So these are very typical stories that people have when they're from Appalachia. I lived in East Tennessee for 30 years, but traveled a little bit to do my PhD and do some work in my field. But now I'm back after a year living in Texas to set the record straight about Appalachia.
All right, I'm going to put you to that test, by the way.
Exactly.
How did you get into Appalachian studies? I mean, what drew you to this kind of genre?
So I need to confess that I'm not actually an expert in Appalachian studies. Okay. I'm a historian. I'm a public historian. Always have a lifelong interest in Appalachian history. But primarily, I am a historian of memory. And so what that means is I'm very interested in the way people remember the past and how people misremember the past. And this has always been the link that's connected me to Appalachian history, the way that myths, like we're going to talk about today, sort of enter the public consciousness, how they get used and reshaped over time. And so my interest in public history, what the public thinks about history, made me sort of naturally attuned to Appalachian history. And of course, being from Appalachia myself helps. But it was this moment, you know, during the election and the success of Hillbilly Elegy, when we had sort of a reawakening and rediscovery of Appalachia in the public consciousness, and working in the field where myths and memory are kind of very relevant to what I do, it was a opportunity for me to start first venting some frustration at the way the region has been depicted, but also sort of trace where some of these myths and fantasies about Appalachia come from.
That was actually going to be my next question, is when you started to notice this drumbeat of inaccurate reporting or commentary that you felt was distorted, do you remember a particular piece?
Yes.
Or genre? Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I'll put it down that I think my first recollection of the genre that I write about in my book and some of my personal writings, this Trump country genre that uses Appalachia as a template to understand the rise of Donald Trump, was in February of 2015 in Vanity Fair, an article appropriately titled Trump Country USA. And so this was
nothing subtle about
subtle about it. And it was a travelogue of the author's accumulated experiences in sort of Charleston, Morgantown, West Virginia. And the theme of it was to understand Donald Trump, you must understand Appalachia. To understand Appalachia, you must understand Donald Trump. And so this momentum really built as political forecasting took shape, as primaries started happening, and all but exploded after the West Virginia primary in May 2016.
And that's something that's interesting, by mm-hmm. the way, that I've seen in other writings, and I can't remember if it was you or somebody else who wrote this, that the West Virginia primary and now President Trump's performance mm-hmm. in that primary got a lot of play for that, for a lot of reasons. One, because some of those counties used to be Union Democratic strongholds. It also fit a narrative about white working class Americans that Donald Trump seemed to be resonating with. But the actual county, to my knowledge, that got the highest percentage of Republican voters in the primary to vote for Donald Trump was Staten Island, New York.
Yeah.
So it had nothing to do with West Virginia at all. So we're already starting with kind of what you're saying is a flawed premise that really grew from that point forward. I can only imagine your frustrations probably grew as well.
Well, I think a great example to look at how these narratives sort of explode and take shape and become detached from reality is if you look at the accumulation of pieces, and we were talking about this a little bit before we went on air, about McDowell County, West Virginia. And so I lost count at about 22 or 23 profiles in mainstream publications, very prestige publications like The New Yorker or Vanity Fair, or the Washington Post, about this county in West Virginia that has 17,000 registered voters, although the number in circulation is probably a little bit lower than that. But Ted Koppel called it unambiguously Trump country. The Guardian said that Donald Trump was more popular in McDowell County than anywhere else in America. And so now that we have the benefit of hindsight, we know the election results, and we know that McDowell County gave Donald Trump around 700 votes in the Republican primary. And about 5,500 votes in the general election. Hmm. So, you know, McDowell County wasn't necessarily Trump country. It's probably more accurate to say that McDowell County was the county that nobody really cared enough to vote county, which is true around a lot of counties in Appalachia, particularly the poorest counties in Appalachia.
We should say, too, that the sort of the historical dismissal of Appalachia or trying to use the people or the region as a starting off point for conversation is not restricted, you know, by any kind of partisan boundaries. I mean, this happens on the left and the right to try to push or pull Appalachia or fit it into a template that best serves whatever point a politician is trying to make.
Right. These narratives are popular, as you said, by people of all political stripes, both sides of the political aisle. Hillbilly LG, for example, this sort of like uber narrative of Appalachia is widely beloved by people on the left and the right. So they take different things out of these narratives, I think, people on the left and the right. People on the right tend to look at these narratives for proof that we have left a certain group of people, a certain class of people, the white working class, behind. And people on the left tend to look at these narratives as proof that we need to empathize more with people who are on the margins of our awareness. So they take different things from these narratives, but the universality of the sort of Appalachian, forgotten Appalachia, is pretty powerful.
I know that you've done a lot of pushback on your blog mm-hmm. About this, and we talked about at the top of the show, you have a book coming out early mm-hmm. next year. As this began to coalesce in your mind, this idea of not liking what you were seeing coming out of these prestigious publications or media sources, how did that begin to form in your mind of a plan of action? Like, I need to say something about this. Here's how I want to do it. What motivated you to go from beyond just being frustrated to wanting to actively combat it?
So the thing that I found most concerning about the early Appalachian pieces, early Trump country pieces that I was seeing was this tendency of the authors to sort of use the plight of Appalachians, real or presumed, to sort of deflect the growing acceptance of racism and misogyny and xenophobia in Trump's campaign and among his base. So the idea was, is if we look at these poor working class people, lower income people, jobless, without hope, filled with despair, it's easier for us to detach the political momentum that was building from some of the very troublesome things promised by a Trump victory. So border walls and travel bans and things of that nature, those left your mind a little bit when you were sort of in the clicking through video logs about McDowell County or, you know, Eastern Kentucky. They were trying to make the point that what we were seeing could be distilled as a kind of broad economic anxiety detached from the other things that we should be talking about when we're talking about the rise of the politics that we were experiencing and now we'll continue to experience.
I want to get back to this point, too. We're going to take a station break shortly, but because I don't want to get us into a 10-minute answer when we have like 3 minutes left, but I'm fascinated by that. That term, economic anxiety, which we've all heard pretty extensively over the last year and a half or so, almost exclusively applied to these places and these people. It's almost always going to be about economic anxiety. What is the mythology of that? I mean, how big a role does, I mean, you were saying that it was sort of used as a sort of a paper over for some maybe more unseemly root causes for President Trump's support or what people were feeling in these parts of the country. What role did economic anxiety actually play in what's going on right now?
Well, I mean, your guess is as good as mine there. I don't think that we've been able to untangle it completely. Economic anxiety is real. I think what we most often see is that people are reacting to realities and daily things that they experience in their everyday lives that are causing them anxiety, that they're thinking about the loss of their status and their weight, but they're just blaming the wrong set of circumstances or the wrong set of experiences. So economic anxiety is real, but we have to look deeper than the answers that these pieces often give us.
If you had to create a template, I mean, it's almost a genre. You talked about it as the Trump Country USA type thing. I called it Coal Country USA before we started.
Exactly.
It's like you and I were talking about the same kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
We hear it on NPR. We get it from the Washington Post. We hear they go to the diner in Brevard, North Carolina, and they talk to some people, and then boom, that's the view. That's my story. Here it is, beginning, middle, and end. If you had to create a template of the things that bug you the most, that crop up most frequently, what are those stories like for people who may want to recognize them in their own media consumption?
I think the thing that I'm most aware of is the sense that people in regions like Appalachia are monolithic, that they only tell one story, that there's only one race or group of people that live there, that there's one brand of politics, and that there's one economy.
That there's this idea that of homogeneity through the entire region, which, by the way, the Appalachians themselves reach at least from upstate New York down to about Montgomery, Alabama. There are cross-cultural lines, there are racial lines, economic. One of your main points that I've seen on your blog and in your writing is that there's a lot more diversity than these pieces, and maybe even we who live here in Appalachia seem to recognize.
There's different sorts of economic diversity going on in the region. One of the things that is really frustrating about these genres is the way that they wed the entire region to the coal industry. And that comes very close to our reality, which is to say that there's not many aspects, many areas of the region that are untouched by the coal industry. Here in East Tennessee, for example, we don't mine coal, but we burn coal through the TVA. So instead of looking at sort of the nuances of the coal industry, we see the industry projected as the face of a white, out-of-work coal miner. And so we have to kind of question why those choices are made. Why are we projecting coal and all the kind of baggage that comes with the coal industry on a person rather than looking at it as a really sophisticated sort of economic system and mono-economy that's come to the region?
We'll come back to that in just a few moments. We're also going to open the phone lines. We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget, we are online, of course. You can tweet us at WUOTFM. You can go to our Facebook page and leave a question there. And, of course, as I said, we'll take phone calls coming up just after the break at 19 minutes after the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues on 91.9 FM WUOT, your NPR news station. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Elizabeth Catt. She's a consultant, historian, and writer who specializes in the myths, the history, culture, and memories of Appalachia. That's what we're talking about this hour on Dialogue. By the way, we want to hear from you. As I said before the break, tweet us at WUOTFM. Leave a question on Facebook, and we're going to open up the phone lines. You can call us at 865-974-5050. Again, that's 974-5050. Before we left, we were talking about how coal has become like the synecdoche for Appalachia, fairly or unfairly. How did coal become the barometer for this entire region? That is what I've heard so much about, but very little of like how it got to be that way.
Right. So the story of Appalachia is the story of coal. It's difficult to separate the two. But I think what we see when we talk about discussions of coal miners in Appalachia in the media today in 2016 and 2017 is really a conflation of coal as a history, as a heritage, with coal as a dominant market force. And what I mean by that is people like to tell stories about how coal miners and unemployed coal workers have really sort of backwards views about what the coal industry has been and where it's going. So we talk a lot about in the media, when will coal miners wise up to the fact that coal is dead and things like that. But I think that when you live in Appalachia, you have lots of complicated ways to sort of talk about coal. Is coal your family history? Is coal your heritage? Is coal the reason why your family members aren't alive? Is coal the reason why your family members are alive? Is it what keeps you in the place where you were born and raised? Is it the thing that's driven you away from your family? And so when we in the region talk about coal, we talk about it through all these different lenses. But when sort of mainstream media comes and talks about coal, we always get the same sort of stories. We get coal is dead, coal is dying, wise up coal miners, or, you know, take what's coming to you, which is sort of more economic instability.
Yeah. There's also been kind of a subgenre, too, that you've written about, primarily of like editorials, op-eds that people have written that are based on opinion, that are more, that have emerged during and after the election last year that are more what's the word, punitive, you know, toward Appalachia. Like, well, this is what you get. You know, you're going to lose your health insurance. You lost your jobs. This is what you get. Tell me a little bit about that genre and how they're getting it wrong or how they're being punitive.
Yeah, so an interesting thing that happened with all the accumulated interest in Appalachia is pieces written before the election tended to sort of preach a type of understanding for people who were presumed to be Trump voters. In Appalachia, we're always presumed to be Trump voters. But the idea that it's just their character, you know, it's just their economic situation that's brought them to this purpose. It's just, you know, their misunderstandings. It's just their lack of education. It's just this, just that. We really need to reach out to them and sort of understand what they've been going through. It was a very sort of, it could be a genre that's very condescending.
Yeah, it sounds patronizing.
Yeah. But after the election, you see a sort of a shift to, as you said, sort of punitive discussions. Let's let Appalachia, you know, take what it, you know, reap what it sowed. Let's, you know, we shouldn't care that coal miners are going to lose their health insurance. This is what they voted for. Even discussions about secession. So, you know, can California be a new state? Can we just divorce all the red states? And so these are all wrapped up into this sort of post-election narrative of Appalachia as a place that needs to be taught a lesson. And that lesson is that it needs to take what's coming to it by voting against its own interests.
Yeah. How do you feel about all that? I know I've read some of your writing where you take issue, obviously, and you say, well, you guys are missing the point, too.
Yeah, it's difficult because a lot of these discussions come from people on the left, so people who are progressive, and this is how they sort of envision what resistance might be in the Trump era, so to kind of insulate themselves against people thought to be dragging them down. And I would like those individuals to understand how sort of right-wing they sound when they sort of deploy these you know, thought exercises. They're, you know, using myths about welfare and welfare queens and who's worthy or unworthy of our assistance. There's not any sort of expression of solidarity to people who might be in these regions, oppressed people, people who don't share the political views that they find objectionable. I wish they could hear what they sound like when they sort of come up with some of these plans to, you know, let Appalachia learn a lesson.
Yeah, it's certainly not taking the rhetorical high road by any stretch, it sounds like. We talked a little bit earlier about how then coal, of course, became like this the single lens, the opaque lens through which Appalachia would be viewed. What's wrong with that picture? And part of that, what I'm trying to get to, is there's more going on economically. Technology, we talked about research. You made a point before we came on the air that the atomic bombs were designed and built in Oak Ridge, which is a part of Appalachia, and certainly in the 40s was, during the war era. So there's a fundamental flaw in trying to think of coal as being the only economic driver in Appalachia.
Right. One of the objections that I have to looking at coal through the lens that the sort of the mainstream media prefers is that if you look at the sort of employment share of the coal industry, you'll find that it's small and it's shrinking beyond hope. So there's only about 36,000 people who work in the coal industry in Appalachia. In a strong coal state like West Virginia, that's only about 16,000. So you have many more people in Appalachia who are working in fields like healthcare, in education, in the hospitality industry. So when we think about who the Appalachian working class is, our mind shouldn't always stray to, a white coal miner, this face of the white working class. The working class in Appalachia is much like the working class in the rest of the country, which tends to skew towards being female and often populated by people of color. So there's ways that Appalachia is being set apart and then also miss some, important connections at the same time. As we were talking about, there's lots of great research institutions in Appalachia who are really trying to think very hard about ways to diversify and get us out of the mono economy that's been, a result of the coal industry. And there's lots of young people who are invested in staying in Appalachia who are doing all kinds of different economic strategies. So some have really hit the creative industries hard. And there's young people who are trying to sort of get the kind of training offered by, for example, the Appalachian Regional Commission. So trying to figure out what the way forward for Appalachia might be and sort of move their skills accordingly.
That is also not a new point. We talked about how some of these myths, they didn't come up in 2016. They've been around for a while. One thing that strikes me is we're right now in the 50th anniversary period for the Lyndon Johnson administration, and one of his key projects was called the Great Society. It envisioned all kinds of legislation that he hoped or thought would elevate, people all across the country. But Appalachia was a pet project for him, and that came up in 1964 with some legislation that was devised, including even down to building superhighways, which I've heard the argument, by the way, that building better highways just made it easier for people to escape Appalachia, which was the opposite of the intended effect. So we got a comment on Twitter earlier today from someone who said, you can kind of understand when Appalachian people are skeptical of someone coming in saying, I'm from the government, I'm here to help, because we sort of tried that already. And it didn't, it didn't move the needle as much, perhaps, as people had hoped for one reason or another. Tell me a little bit then about this kind of, because that's another sort of popular canard that gets trotted out there, the folks who are skeptical. They're skeptical of the government. They're skeptical of outsiders. They're skeptical of free trade. They don't like anything. Let's bust that myth, too.
This is one of my favorite myths because it often is presented as something like a hillbilly code. So if you are skeptical of people in authority, if you're skeptical of experts or the government, even doctors, it's not anything that's based on our lived experiences in Appalachia. It's because we have a hillbilly code that we skew towards lawlessness and sort of anti-authoritarian attitudes. But the reality is that people in Appalachia have good reason to be skeptical when somebody comes in and says, hey, I've figured out a great way to fix your problems. I'm going to give you a little bit of money, and then we're going to see how this shakes out. Like you said, the war on poverty in many ways left us with success stories in the region. The Appalachian Regional Commission is, in many ways an important program that had a lasting influence on the region. But in other aspects, the war on poverty was a complete failure because what it did was I use this example a lot that the war on poverty is like a town in West Virginia where the road washes out because of strip mining. Mm-hmm. And so to repair that road, people will go ask the coal company, hey, can we use your private roads? And the coal company says no. And then they'll ask, you know, their municipal leaders, hey, can you help us repair the road? And the, you know, the municipal political leaders say no because they're corrupt. And so what the War on Poverty did was come in and build the road, but mm-hmm. it didn't do anything to reshape the experiences that people had living in these communities that manifested intense political corruption and sort of corporate exploitation.
That is a point that is made by a book that you've recommended on your website, and I thought it was quite interesting. It's about this era. It's mm-hmm. called They'll Cut Off Your Project. It's by a guy named Hugh Perry. He worked in Mingo County, West Virginia, and it was part of the War on Poverty, part of that Great Society legislation. And he writes pretty extensively and vividly about the battles he fought with local leaders who wanted to divert the federal money to themselves, rig elections, stuff ballot boxes. This is stuff that cannot necessarily be fixed, you know, in the sense of fixing something, like tightening a screw on a loose refrigerator mm-hmm. door. I mean, this is something that's much more complex than that. Tell us a little bit about some of those, the framework under which Mr. Perry had to work and struggled against, and some of that may still be around.
Right. So Hugh Perry is just, I think he's a fascinating person. What he tried to do was really brilliant. He tried to rig the War on Poverty to work for poor people, which...
Imagine that.
Yeah, which sounds, it sounds incredible, but that's what he actually had to do, because what would happen is the War on Poverty was administered by a vast hierarchy of bureaucrats and anti-poverty workers and administrators. And so when federal money came to Appalachia, what a lot of local leaders wanted to do was just take it for themselves, to siphon it into their own projects, to buy votes, to get patronage. And so we didn't see a lot of money going into hands of the people who actually needed it. And what Hugh Perry wanted to do was involve poor people in every level of their local government, whether it was trying to get a cooperative grocery store, so that when people went to buy groceries, they weren't paying inflated prices, that they could use government assistance to actually buy the things that they needed ethically, to get better wages for school teachers, to get roads repaired, all these different things that just hadn't happened, not because, you know, people in Appalachia hadn't thought, wow, it'd be great if we had a road to drive on, or, you know, it'd be great if we had windows in our schools. It was because whenever funds would materialize to make these improvements, that, you know, they tended to get sucked away by corporate interest or corrupt political leaders. And so one of the things that I, you know, a point that I try to make looking at Perry's work is we have this narrative in the region that Appalachians always vote against their own interests. But we also see that in the past, at least some of the reason why that might be was due to factors like political corruption.
Right, that they may not have gotten a chance to vote for or against their own interests, right, because the election had already been decided mm-hmm. at some point. Well, let's talk a little bit about, let's use this as a segue to get into the work of J.D. Vance. You've referenced him just a little bit earlier in the hour. He's a man who has come into real prominence in the last year and a half because of his 2016 memoir called Hillbilly Elegy. Many of us in the audience may be familiar with that, or at least have read it mm-hmm. or heard of it. This became held up as a kind of, I've seen this term used online, as a kind of a Rosetta Stone. People started just falling down at his feet, like, oh, finally, somebody can explain Appalachia to us. You and other writers have said, not so fast. Let's begin with kind of a broad explanation of, like, what bothers you about his analysis or the story that he's conveyed in that book?
So I think Hillbilly Elegy is a great example of what we were talking about earlier, about how narratives of Appalachia kind of experience intense popularity from people on both sides of the political aisle. And Hillbilly Elegy is certainly anchored to politics, but it's been received with a lot of relief that, you know, oh, at last somebody is here to tell us about, you know, these people that really vex America, that are really misunderstood. So what we have to think about when we think about Hillbilly Elegy is that it's two things. It's, and, you know, the title will tell us this too, it's a personal memoir, but it's also the memoir of a culture. And so we've had discussions of this at, you know, sort of Appalachian studies. What exactly is a memoir of a culture, and how do you write the memoir of a culture? And this is where most of my criticisms of Vance's book and his celebrity fall. His attempt to write a memoir of a culture that doesn't exist in the way that he says it exists. So in his mind, Appalachian culture is remarkably cohesive, that it's underpinned by genetic and ethnic similarities. So he relies on sort of this mythical dominance of Scotch-Irish people in Appalachia to kind of smooth out the wrinkles in his theory. He argues that our culture is in decline, that people in Appalachia have almost reproduced negative social consequences and social effects through propensity for addiction, for example, shirking work, abusing the welfare system is sort of some of his favorite examples of this. And this leads him to the conclusion that the only way to fix Appalachia is not through any sort of government programs or any sort of assistance, but people sort of overcoming their own character, finding it within themselves to think hard about their own problems, modify their behavior, and probably most likely leave the region like he did.
Which is interesting because, I mean, if you have to leave the region to find your success, that's not really a cure for what ails Appalachia. That just tells you to leave, which we talked about a moment ago. So, and something that strikes me that is interesting, too, and maybe you could speak more to this, is, yeah, this idea that one book was held up as the explanatory text, which would seem ridiculous if we were making the same kind of gestures and overtures about a person who wrote a memoir who happened to be from North Dakota. And then we all said, finally, we understand North Dakota. And I've never heard that argument about other states or other regions, but a guy comes out with a book and suddenly we understand Appalachia. So there's a folly about, too, on the part of outsiders or anybody who's reading this book who may not be familiar with Appalachia, to say that one person in one book could be the key. I mean, that seems like a logical flaw to me.
Well, this is something that actually happens a lot in the region. So Appalachia is 25 million people spread out over 700,000 square miles, 13 states, 420 counties. But yeah, we're left with this one book that is going to explain the problems and the pathologies of Appalachia. But, you know, 50 years ago, and we were just talking about the war on poverty, we had a predecessor of J.D. Vance, Harry Caudle, who said, I, you know, am also a person that can explain to you the problems and pathologies of Appalachia. And his focus was much more on the environmental consequences of coal mining. But it's still that same sort of, you know, interest in looking at Appalachia, but only through one sort of person, one voice, one viewpoint.
We'll pause now for a station break. Don't forget that our number is 974-5050. You can also tweet us at WUOTFM or leave a question, as Bob recently did on our Facebook page. Bob, we'll get to your question right after the break. It is 38 minutes after the hour, and this is Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues on 91.9 FM WUOT, your NPR news station. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, very pleased to be with you, and of course, pleased to join a very, very smart person who I've enjoyed talking with this hour, Dr. Elizabeth Catt. And we're going to continue along with a question that we got from Facebook just a moment ago, which actually harkens back to something we talked about earlier on in the show, which is Appalachia as the metaphor or the pathway to understanding Trump voters or, you know, populism or what have you. The question is from Bob on Facebook, who says, since Trump's political success in West Virginia and other places was due to low voter turnout, what about places with historically high voter turnout where he was just as successful? And he cites states in west of the Mississippi. Why do journalists seem to be less interested in the American West as the symbol for Trump country than they do for Appalachia? I don't know if you can necessarily speak to journalists' motives, but it's definitely a phenomenon you and I have talked about.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic question, and it's one that I sort of struggle with myself. We have, you know, different parallels between Appalachia and the American West. It's a place where certainly the imagination can run wild and you know, and invent different forms of narratives. We also have connections to coal mining. We have sort of this rugged way of American life that's rooted in white masculinity. So why does, you know, the template for Trump country become someplace in West Virginia as opposed to, you know, Wyoming? Honestly, I don't know. Yeah. Except the way that I can answer that and the way that I think about it is that we have these narratives of Appalachia that go back 150 years. So there's more precedent for Appalachia, you know, to fill these sort of voids in our understanding with stories from our region going back from after the Civil War to, you know, last week. There's a template for journalists to work for that I think is more accessible in Appalachia than it is for different regions.
I wonder, too, if geography might play a role. If
sure.
If you work in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, it's easier to get to Appalachia
oh, absolutely.
Than to fly out to Colorado or somewhere. So the geography might be a role, too. To get back to J.D. Vance for a moment, before we move on, I want to give him a little fair credit here to say, are there areas where he gets it right, where his analysis is particularly clear-eyed, or there can be a lesson drawn from it that might be more widely applicable or at least informative to people who want to understand the region?
No.
Okay. Well,
but
tell me
I will say that a lot of people have related to the way that he describes his personal struggles. And I don't have any sort of criticism or objection to the things that he writes and speaks about that might be extremely personal, might be more of this personal memoir that he's selling. And I think that people have appreciated the candor that he talks about his struggles and the struggles of his family with. But I think that this is a very dangerous way to look at Appalachia that he's peddling. It's one that, it kind of takes the things that we were talking about that frustrate us, this homogenous and monolithic narrative, and, it injects steroids into them and says not only is the region monolithic, it's got another layer on top of it because it's only through the lens or the eyes of one person. Mm-hmm. And so we're at a moment in Appalachia where we need to think about the next 50 years, what the transition between the mono economy of coal is going to be like, and how are we going to bring our region forward out of the shadow of coal. And this is a time for creativity, for shattering myths, for shattering stereotypes, for making new narratives for ourselves. And J.D. Vance has placed us in a narrative that's straight out of the 1960s.
Which maybe even is worse or becomes worse because it was such a popular book, it has been read all over the place, and seems to reinforce the very myths we've been talking about.
Right. It's very much a culture of poverty narrative, which, ultimately says that the way out of poverty is not through assistance or through government intervention or anything like that. It's just about poor people doing better, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps.
Why don't you be less poor?
Yeah, why don't you, be less poor, go to church, maybe do military service, mm-hmm. Enact appropriate forms of masculinity. So there's all these little prescriptions in there, but we don't see anything in J.D. Vance's work that we didn't see in sort of armchair sociology of the 1960s.
Some of these myths we've been talking about are kind of self-cultivated and have made it down through the generations within Appalachia. Mm-hmm. An interesting one you alluded to earlier, but I want to get some more detail on this, the Scotch-Irish or Scots-Irish myth. Tell us what the myth is and what's wrong with that.
So there's a popular myth in Appalachia that the sort of dominant heritage here is Scotch-Irish. This is not to say that there aren't people in Appalachia and many of them that do have this heritage and sort of celebrate it in different ways. But the myth goes something like, after the pilgrims came, there were, other kinds of white people that came to America, and those that were Scottish and those that were Irish came to Appalachia and they settled here because they really loved mountains. And then once they were here, the mountains sort of insulated their culture from outside forces and left them with our peculiar way of speech or left them with clannish or tribal nature, relics of an honor culture. And this is where the Scotch-Irish myth comes from. It's been deployed recently in popular history. So you might remember Virginia politician Jim Webb's Born Fighting about the Scotch-Irish culture in America. And it's, when he tries to recuperate some of the negative things that people have said about Appalachia, but only using the lens of Scotch-Irish heritage. So it's, it's attached to popular history as well. It's not really the case. There's lots, any kind of ethnicity is reflected in Appalachia, from Swiss to German to Polish to Italian, people of African descent, obviously people of indigenous descent. So anything that was going on in the American colony, the American colonies or pre-settlement is in Appalachia as well. But this myth is sort of very widespread, and it does a lot of work in Hillbilly Elegy.
All right, we're going to go to the phones. David in Knoxville, you have a question. Go right ahead.
This is John.
Oh, terribly sorry. Well, all right, John, go right ahead with your question.
Okay. I'm not sure how to frame this succinctly, but the best I can, the the difference, as one who's grown up in Knoxville, the Knoxville of my youth, which was very parochial and quite corrupt, is an entirely different city from the city I live in now. The change has been dramatic, I think, because we have pretty good leadership in Knoxville. The leadership of the state as a whole, and I know only part of Tennessee is actually Appalachia, but I'm thinking in particular of the suppression of medical assistance, not only in rejecting Obamacare, but even the Insure Tennessee that Bill Haslam projected, which was endorsed by a conservative politician, that our state legislature seems to suppress things that could have that could help their citizens, their constituents, and as a result, the rural hospitals are disappearing one by one in Tennessee. So I'm wondering if, what you feel the role of the leadership is in the condition of Appalachia that you're describing, and how we can address that.
John, that's an excellent point. We talked earlier about the War on Poverty. That was a federal program, skepticism toward the federal government. We haven't talked so much about states and local municipalities, the sort of the change from within. What can you tell us about that?
Well, obviously, it varies state to state and locality to locality. I think what we see in Appalachia, there's some universal things that are seen throughout the region. We have a lot of undue influence of corporate interests at work in our politics in the region, whether it's the coal industry, pharmaceutical industry. Unfortunately, West Virginia is a state that has both. And also this idea that people can fix themselves. So people in our state politics really do subscribe to bootstrapping narratives as well. And I appreciate your caller's comment that healthcare is going to be so important to brainstorming ways to sort of take us into the new phase of Appalachia economic growth. And I worked on the Insure Tennessee campaign, and I was sorry to see that it was rejected. But absolutely, we need to kind of feel our way through what will give us our best shot for the region in the future. And a lot of those are very basic, but also important things like access to medical care and access to health care.
Which again speaks to the complexity of any one of these issues, that it's not a single book or a single person who can speak for, you know, an entire, or even a single industry for that matter, that there's as much complexity in Appalachia as there would be in almost any other region. We've talked about the ways in which people here might feel disconnected from other parts of the country, the West or the Northeast, the elites versus not. But there are surely divisions within Appalachia, too, and that's something that John referenced in his call just a moment ago, that Knoxville is different than it was 50 years ago. When I think about, we have major cities in Appalachia, Charlotte, Atlanta, major regional hubs. Appalachia goes up to Maryland and Pennsylvania, places we wouldn't normally think of culturally. So I'm thinking the experience of someone who lives in an urban area is going to be different than that, than the person who lives in Gate City or Brevard or somewhere like that. Do you think there's anything to the idea of people feeling disconnected from one another in Appalachia based on city versus country?
Yeah, so Appalachia is to be Appalachian, it's a really flexible identity. You can live in Appalachia and not identify as Appalachian. For example, people in Pittsburgh might not see their identity as Appalachian, even though they live within the Appalachian region. People in metropolitan areas might not see themselves connected to this idea of Appalachian as strongly as people, for example, in North Carolina, around Appalachian State.
Right.
So yeah, there's the disconnect there. There are many different Appalachians in Appalachia, within Appalachia, and so I think, economically speaking, we're going to have a lot more diversity, economic diversity, and our bigger urban areas, our smaller areas might have a tougher time. And this kind of builds into this narrative that we always talk about before, that if you want to be successful in Appalachia, you have to leave Appalachia. And so there's lots of ways to migrate within the region as well. To leave the region might not necessarily look like going somewhere on the coast. You could try to move to a more substantial and economically diverse region within the same state or within the same kind of metropolitan area.
How do reporters and editors start doing a better job of telling these Appalachian stories? If you had to create the template for a better way to at least get the story told, what would you like to see?
I have a lot of interesting conversations with reporters who call me and they're on an Appalachian beat or assigned to write an Appalachian story, and they don't honestly have basic facts about the region. I was talking to a reporter the other day, and I said something about black lung, and they were surprised that people still get black lung in, you know, 2016, 2017, but of course that's a big public health issue in Appalachia as well. So ways to get Appalachia better, show the region's diversity, however you want to define diversity, if it's diversity of political thought, if it's diversity, if it's racial diversity, if it's diversity of, you know, economic interest. There's nowhere in America that's going to be as homogenous as these stories represent. So dig into there and see what those stories are. I think it's really interesting, and this is, you know, aligned with my politics, but the way, you know, there were no stories about Appalachia of anybody with any sort of progressive politics during the election cycle. And this is notable, not because I want to inject my politics here, but because these stories also contain a call for people to do this, do that, stand up, resist, all of these things. So if you're, you know, preaching that people need to do something, please look within the region to see if there's, you know, not already a large group of people there already doing that. You know, I read a story that said, well, it'd be great if Appalachians would stand up to the coal industry. And we actually have, you know, the largest concentration of anti-coal activists in the region because, of course, the coal industry is, you know, something that we deal with. It's reshaped our region.
Yeah.
So look within the region, tell different stories, tell stories of diversity, find younger voices, find people doing, you know, political organizing, labor organizing, give them a platform. Let people from Appalachia write their own stories too. You don't always have to come into the story, you know, come into the region to tell our story. You know, find somebody in Appalachia who can write, you know, the story of what's going on the ground.
Yeah. Well, you did a little bit of this earlier this year when the women's marches were taking place shortly after the inauguration. And you talked about marches that were going on in Asheville and Knoxville and Roanoke, Virginia, and places like that. They didn't get nearly as much national play as those that happened in major cities. And the point you were trying to make, I think, in your essay was about this political diversity, this diversity of thought that was taking place that was not getting a whole lot of play.
Right. Anything that has to do with progressive politics is usually sort of second fiddle to stories about sort of entrenched conservatism, red state narratives in Appalachia. And I personally think that if you are of the political mindset that we need stories of resistance and we need stories of, you know, different forms of organizing, that Appalachia is where you need to look because we have lived with some of the things that the nation is about to go through for much, much longer. We've got, you know, problems with corporate interests, monopolies, you know, corrupt politicians. All of these things are things that we are very, you know, I don't want to say comfortable, but we're you know,
that
used
experience.
We are used to dealing with these issues. And so if that's where you want to find your inspiration from these stories, Appalachia has many to offer.
Do you have much hope that that's going to happen in the near future? And the reason I say that is that presuming that the media interest doesn't die down, because of course news cycles change and we're all going to go as a herd, go follow something else tomorrow, you know. But assuming that the interest continues and the curiosity lasts, do you see any chance of this turning around as people maybe become a little more educated about it? I don't know. I mean,
I'm going to say that I have hope, and I'll say it because there are brilliant people in Appalachia who are staying in the region, who are trying to make a difference. And I think we have so many different kinds of platforms, of course. These stories of monolithic and homogenous and backwards Appalachia will always get, like, I think, the bigger platform. But we have democratic platforms available to us now. We can blog and use Twitter and sort of self-publish and make connections online and in different spaces. So I really believe that we'll see more people from the region trying to tell their own stories and their own thoughts and offer their own expertise about the region.
Have you noticed a qualitative difference between the national sources that, like, we kind of invented the mythical reporters from the Post and the Wall Street Journal who come in versus somebody who works for the Charleston Daily Mail Gazette in West Virginia? Or, you know, is there a qualitative difference between people who already work here telling that story?
I think, and there's lots of different projects we can look at. There's, for example, the 100 Days in Appalachia project, which is does all kinds of media related to the region. But I think a good example is the way that the opioid crisis has been covered. So you look at papers in West Virginia, the Charleston Gazette, which I think might have won a Pulitzer for their coverage. So when they're covering the opioid crisis, they're kind of digging deep into these connections between the pharmaceutical industry, between consumer regulation. They're putting it into a narrative that's not unfamiliar in the region. So using Appalachia as sort of a laboratory for sort of capitalism. But people outside the region want to tell stories about, well, the opioid crisis is it's a symptom of despair of the white working class. And so they're using narratives that are familiar with their audiences. Mm. And so there's definitely truth within both perspectives. But it's one where you say there's a difference between the stories that are being told inside and outside the region.
How well do you think folks like us who are coming from the inside are doing in reaching the outside? I know you said you've become kind of a hot commodity for reporters who are calling you saying, tell me about this place. I mean, what's going on? So there's obviously some interest from the outside to hear these divergent voices. What are you hearing about that?
So I think Hillbilly LG has been maybe more of a curse, but also a little bit of a blessing to the region in the sense that it's made people who are sort of fed up with Hillbilly LG want to seek out different voices. And so I know that there's a lot of projects that are going on right now, both academic and popular, that are going to deconstruct some of what this narrative about Appalachia has been built up through the election and the popularity of this book. So I think that, we're going to find more ways to get our voices heard. And I'm hopeful that that will happen as more people sort of look at the region and see what different kinds of things that we do here.
Final and briefly, I know you have a book coming out early next year. Is there anything we haven't covered so far that you think is worth mentioning? One of these myths that kind of won't seem to die that you want to make sure we bust before we get out of here?
I just think that the biggest myth that I struggle with is that Appalachia is, as we've been talking about this entire program, homogenous. Think about why those stories exist. They exist because somebody finds them valuable, not just intellectually, but also monetarily. So always think about when you see these narratives of Appalachia, think about the economies that they exist in. Because somebody, if you trace a flawed narrative back far enough, somebody is going to be making money, and it's not going to be somebody in Appalachia usually.
All right, we'll leave it there. And a fascinating discussion. Dr. Elizabeth Catt, again, a consultant, historian, and writer who talks about the myth and memory of Appalachia. Her book, What You Are Getting Wrong About Appalachia, is expected in early 2018. Dr. Catt, thank you so much for being the guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, indeed. Thanks to everybody who called in, who sent us questions on Twitter and Facebook. We couldn't do it without you. Our producer is Greg Hill. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Stay tuned for Afternoon Concert next on 91.9 FM WUOT.